Welcome to another episode of the Self Storage Insight Podcast. If you're like me, you hate paying capital gains tax. And so in today's episode, we are going to talk about utilizing the 1031 exchange as you are going from selling an asset to buying a new asset and how you can defer that tax burden. Let's get into it. Welcome to the Self Storage Insight Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dave Foster, and I'm very excited about the conversation. We're going to be talking about investing in self-storage today. Dave has actually written a book, Lifetime Tax-Free Wealth, and the Real Estate Investor's Guide to the 1031 Exchange. And so, Dave, thank you so much for taking some time to join me on the podcast today. Super excited for the conversation.
Hey, it's great to be here. You know, if you take a look at the back cover of that book, you'll see the six reasons why I thought real estate investing was so important. It gave me the freedom to live a life with them on our sailboat. And as a real estate investor, so we have never looked back. We love it. And we've done it all tax-free.
Awesome. So yeah, talk to me, I guess, a little bit. Maybe we'll just kind of start with, you know, what was your inspiration behind writing the book about the 1031 exchange and kind of your need for seeing that needed to be written there?
30 years ago, Ben, I sold my first piece of property. My wife and I were trying to get off the corporate train. And we thought, we're going to become real estate investors. We're going to buy a sailboat. And we're going to go sail off with our kids. Now, that may sound normal or not to somebody. But when you factor in that neither one of us had ever owned real estate, she was from Minneapolis. I was from Kansas. We met in Denver. So far, I don't see real estate or water anywhere, but right. That's what we decided. So I bought a duplex. I fixed it up. I rented it. I sold it. I thought I did really well on it till my accountant at the end of the year said, hey, you need to write a check for $30,000 mm-hmm. for the taxes. Well, that was not part of the plan.
Right.
And I went, wow, holy cow. It still haunts me to this day. Because anybody that does compounding interest spreadsheets will be able to tell you that if you take $30,000 and you have the use of it and get to make the money off of it for 30 years, mm-hmm. you're going to have more than $1 million
right.
from that one transaction
yep.
that I didn't do. So I went on a search to find a better way. Mm-hmm. And right at that time, there was a huge court case settled by the IRS in favor of a taxpayer named Starker. So that from that point, folks like you and I were going to be able to sell investment real estate and then use a process and go buy investment real estate and not have to pay the tax in the middle. Mm-hmm. That tax got to stay with me.
Right.
And I get to make the benefit. Well, that's what the 1031 exchange is. Mm-hmm. And because we then, I said, my gosh, this is the answer. We started doing it for ourselves. Friends and I started a company to do that for others. But the one thing that was lacking was education.
Right.
Because imagine a ticked off IRS. They lose a court case. They're not going to make it easy for you.
Right, for sure.
Let you do it. So it was up to folks like us to educate the public. But what we were able to do, and because some of the water theme, the sailing theme in there, we were able in 10 years to move our portfolio from Colorado to Connecticut to Florida. We used the 1031 exchange to position ourselves into a vacation rental portfolio and some commercial stuff and other things. And we were able to carve out chunks by selling primary residences and taking that tax-free money so that in 10 years, we bought a 53-foot sailboat with tax-free dollars. We lived on it with our children for 10 years.
Awesome.
Living off the income from our tax-deferred vacation rentals.
So I guess, can we maybe jump into a little bit of like what business types, commercial, residential, multifamily, self-storage would be, mainly our audience is going to be in self-storage. How can, you know, different industries and different types benefit from a 1031 exchange? And what kind of crossover is there? Because as far as my understanding of the 1031, it has to be a like business asset or a like asset as far as when you're utilizing the exchange. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Is what business?
Yeah, it is only investment real estate for investment real estate. It used to be up until 2018, we could exchange airplanes and heavy equipment and that kind of stuff. But now it's truly just real estate. But here's what's great. The definition of like kind simply means any type of real estate.
Okay.
There's another phrase that you that's called qualified use. So qualified real estate that is like kind and is qualified by use is any type of real estate as long as it's used for investment.
Okay.
So the two general types that don't qualify, obviously your primary residence, but the rules are better. That's tax-free. Fix and flip properties, where you buy a property not intending to hold it,
right,
but intending to resell it, don't qualify for 1031. But other than that, anything goes. So here's where some clients of ours have used this really well to meet where the market was. You remember after 2008, once things kind of got stabilized, everybody was buying single family rentals because they were everywhere.
Right.
They were foreclosed on, they were cheap. And then where did they move into? People started to then see the value of multifamily. So they would 1031 exchange, sell their single family, go buy multifamily. Now, somewhere along in there, some bright folks like yourself figured out that whether there's a recession or not, everybody needs a place to store junk.
Right.
So they went from multifamily or single family investing, residential, into the commercial aspect of buying self-storage facilities. Doing it all without paying tax. And I got a bunch of clients that their model was, they would go in and buy these little mom and pops that are everywhere around the country, right?
Right.
Sometimes they came with U-Haul franchises and sometimes not. But they would buy these things and then they hadn't been modernized for 30 years. You know, the owner still lived in a mobile home on the back 30.
Right.
You have to meet you out front. Yeah. So they would put in systems like electronic monitoring, payments, gates, everything.
Right.
And then they would rent them up, which did what? Automatically increase the value.
Yep.
And then they would sell them in 1031 into two small, run-down mom-and-pop self-storage facilities.
Right.
Fix them up, rent them up, sell them, go buy two more. It's become a whole cottage industry for a ton of people. And so, you're right there at the epicenter.
Yeah, so
that's what the 1031 gives you, the flexibility to go anywhere in the country, any type of real estate.
Right. So maybe just on the timeline type, on the timeline side of it, fix and flip doesn't qualify. How long do you have to hold a property before it qualifies?
That's a great question. No one really knows.
Just as long as the intent is not to fix and flip, then you're good.
Well, that's exactly right. You said the right word. The IRS does not give us a statutory period.
Okay.
What they say is that must have been your intent to hold that property for productive use. Now, what are the extremes on the spectrum? Everybody feels comfortable pretty much with more than a year. Takes you into capital gains, long-term capital gains. There's some court cases that reference two tax years and those kind of things. But there's very little magic to that. Now, the other end of the things is you buy the property, you sell it that same afternoon. What was your intent? Was it really to hold it?
Right.
Probably not. But what kinds of things can demonstrate that your intent was solid? What if you buy a property and you're intending to rent it, but while you're rehabbing it, someone walks in and said, "Man, I see your for rent sign. This is beautiful. Would you just sell it to me instead?" That's an unsolicited offer to buy. You weren't trying to sell it.
Right.
Or what if you put a renter in there and 3 weeks later, a meth lab opens up next door and your renters leave and you can't rent it because of the neighborhood now? Can you demonstrate your intent?
Right.
Or my favorite client of all time, actually took pictures of the bear with his ring photograph from his door.
Okay.
Because the bear took up residence at the trash cans for the house.
Right.
And the tenant moved out because they were too scared of the bear. He'd owned the property for 90 days. Yeah. He said, Dave, my account has the pictures. We dare the IRS to challenge our intent.
Right. I think that story is actually in the book, right?
It is in the book.
I did see that. Awesome.
It is one of those stories because you can use so many different things to demonstrate your intent.
Right.
But you do just want to be careful. People sometimes want to be cowboys. And I just say, you know what? A good accident can happen once in a while.
Right.
But when the same accident happens 5 or 6 times a year, don't kid yourself. The IRS is going to think it's a little less.
Right. You know. For sure. So as far as the 1031 exchange goes in the time frame that you have between selling an asset and then using that to purchase another asset or a down payment on another asset, how much time do you have? Does it have to be in the same fiscal year, or kind of what's your time frame to defer that tax burden?
It can grow across a fiscal year. That's kind of cool. And that actually leaves you with an opportunity, because if you start your 1031 in 1 year and for whatever reason it goes across into the next year and then you don't complete it, your accountant has the option to either make the gain payable for the tax year you started it, or you can wait another 12 months and actually pay the gain 12 to 18 months later.
Okay.
So if you're going across, that's just kind of a neat little hack.
Right.
That's in there. Again, I think that's one of the tricks we talk about in the book. But this is where the devil's in the details. Because again, remember, the IRS isn't going to make it easy.
Right.
So you only have 45 days from the day you close your sale to identify your potential replacement properties. After day 45, you're stuck with whatever's on that list and cannot change it. And there's some limitations to how many properties you can put on that list.
Okay.
So the IRS isn't letting you just name everything you want.
Right.
Generally, if you're buying bigger than you sell, you're only going to be able to name up to 3 properties on your list. But that's kind of a false security net. Because really, if you put 3 properties on your list, you negotiate on one to get it under contract. 30 days later, it falls out.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the odds are that those other 2 are still available?
Right.
So I tell people, treat the 45-day period not as just something to identify. Treat it as an, oh my gosh, I've got to get this new property under contract. And right. Then that will edge things. Now, you could also go into contract for your new property even before your old property closes. So a lot of our folks will get a buyer for their property. They'll get it under contract, and then they'll immediately go into contract on their new property.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps with the 45-day period. But it also, people don't think about this, but it helps you restart your cash flow that much more quickly by bunching the sale and the purchase close together.
Right.
But the worst case scenario for you is you've got another 45 days from the day you close your sale. You have a total of 180 days to take title to the property.
Okay.
That's usually not such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That 45 days can catch you.
Right. Yeah. And so I guess I'm curious too, to see as far as with your experience, as far as you do consulting and things like that with 1031 exchanges. And so how much have you seen it change, you know, now that interest rates have jumped over the last year and a half to 2 years, has that affected it a lot to where people are less likely to maybe sell something that they had locked in at a lower interest rate? And then be able to utilize the 1031 exchange and then moving in from, 3% interest rate into a 7 to 8 to 9% range with where we're at now.
You know, there's definitely a reality to that, but I think it's overstated. I haven't seen any data to back up what I'm thinking or not, but it's definitely entering into people's thoughts because they're now having to look a little longer and harder. Do I sell this property with a 2.5% interest rate, knowing that I'm having to go buy something at 6 or 7 or whatever? And The answer to that is that the reality is when you start comparing, if it's a $500,000 property, then that's a difference of what, $25,000 a year in interest that you're going to pay more. Well, that's a lot. But the appreciation is still so great that what they're giving up, say $20,000 in additional interest, is being offset by $200,000 of appreciation gain. So they're still kind of coming down on the side of, well, yeah, I'm going to sell, because they always think that they can find a good bargain and then start the growth process again. And I think the best philosophy that I've seen on that is you do want to consider the interest you're paying, absolutely, because it's a factor. But you want to remember two things. First of all, if you have underwritten your properties correctly, you're not paying any of that interest. Your tenants are. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a tax write-off, you don't care. But secondly, a property that's right, they say marry the property. In other words, that's where you're looking at for your real value. Date the rate. Because we pretty much all think that given time, rates are going to fluctuate down, mm-hmm. just like they fluctuate up.
Right.
So at some point in time, if you own the perfect property, you're going to get a chance to refinance it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then you got the best of both worlds. You got the perfect property and the perfect rate.
Right. So something that's pretty common for sure recently with the hike in interest rates has been, you know, in self-storage owner financing, when people are looking to sell at a lower cap rate than the interest rates are listed at, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of financial sense for somebody to buy and borrow at a higher rate than the cap rate of the facility. Right. So how does owner financing kind of play into the 1031 exchange? Is there a way that you can still make that work with that type of a purchase?
Well, that's on the owner financing is going to be on two sides, right? If you're trying to buy a property to complete your 1031 exchange, and you want to get that seller to give you an advantageous interest rate by carrying the financing, that acts just like a regular loan. It doesn't matter where you get the money to purchase your property from.
Okay.
As long as you purchase at least as much as you sell and use all the proceeds, you'll defer all tax. So that side of it's relatively easy. You sell a property, go and buy a property with owner financing. That's awesome. On the opposite side, though, what if you're the seller and you're having a hard time unloading it? Well, that's when you might be tempted to offer somebody seller financing. Mm-hmm. And you can do that with a 1031 exchange, but the proceeds from your sale all have to be spent in the purchase of your new property. And one of the proceeds of your sale is that note. Because mm-hmm. the note has value. So in simple terms, let's say you're selling a property for $100,000 and you take a $20,000 down payment and you carry $80,000 in a note. Well, to do a 1031 exchange on it, the $20,000 has to go into your exchange account. So does the $80,000 note. And you have to use both of those to buy a property worth $100,000. Well, the problem is you're going to go to the seller of the property you want to buy and say, hey, would you take $20,000 in this note? And they'll say, no.
Right.
You could sell that note on the open market. Sometimes you do well on it. Generally, you're going to take a big discount. Mm-hmm. The answer when using a 1031 exchange is to go find $80,000 from somewhere. Doesn't matter where, your own cash, a loan from Uncle Ted, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then swap the note for $80,000. So into your exchange account now, you have $100,000 in cash, don't you? Mm-hmm. So you can go buy your next property, no problem at all. Mm-hmm. But also outside your exchange account, you're getting income from a note. And because that note, will you purchase that note out of your exchange account at its par value, there's no tax in it. So it's tax-free income, except for the interest allocation for it.
Right.
So what a great way to keep moving forward with, say, your self-storage business model. But at the same time, you're starting to invest in notes. Mm-hmm. They're just notes that you are the primary creator of.
Right.
And it's not for everybody. You got to have that source of cash, but it's one way of doing it that can be pretty handy.
Absolutely. So what are some pitfalls or some things to look out for, or maybe, you know, some downside to 1031 exchanges that people don't realize, or some things to take caution in there?
Laser focus is absolutely required for where and what you want to invest in. We do internal audits periodically, just informal ones. And what we found is that even in the hottest part of this market, that 92 to 93% of our clients were still completing 1031 exchanges because they were laser focused and they were able to find what they wanted when they wanted. But if you sell your property and the 45-day starts and you're still trying to figure out whether you want to invest in California or New York or Texas, and you're not quite sure whether it's vacation rentals or single families or storage facilities, I can just about bet you that your exchange is doomed because you're going to have too much to analyze. You're not going to be able to make good decisions. And then you're going to realize that and you're going to get scared and you're going to say, forget it. We're just going to pay the tax.
Right. So start preparing. So start preparing prior to the sale of whatever asset you're going to need to unload, for sure.
I love the people that call me 6 months before they even put their contract, their property on the market. I talked to a lady today, and because she's going to take the next 6 months now, invest, she wants to go into multifamily from commercial. I said, have you ever owned multifamily? No. Okay. Are you a real estate investor? She goes, no, I'm a business person, but I want to become a real estate investor. I said, well, your education is all set up for you. For the next 6 months, you're going to find every multifamily property that's in your price range that's for sale within 30 miles of you. And we're going to start doing an analysis on every one of them. Now, you're not going to buy any of them, right? But you're going to be so well educated that when your old property sells, you're going to recognize a good deal the instant you see it. And you can jump on it. So yeah, plan earlier rather than later. That's definite advice. And I would say the other big thing is that too many people don't recognize that there is a downside and an upside to 1031 investing, no matter when you do it. The best time to start a 1031 exchange and sell your property is when? In a seller's market. What's the worst time to buy a property and complete a 1031 exchange? A seller's market.
Right.
What's the worst time to start an exchange? A buyer's market, because you're going to have to take that discount. But what's the best time to complete a 1031 exchange? A buyer's market, where you've got choices everywhere. So you just kind of have to realize that you got to recognize where you're at with the market. Don't be unrealistic. When people brag to me about, look what I was able to get for my property, but then they complain that everybody that's wanting to sell to them is wanting top dollar, I always ask them, what did you expect? Right. You really think you were going to be able to sell for top dollar, but they aren't?
Right.
Instead, look at the fundamentals and buy within that range of what makes a good deal. And if you're really, really, really lucky, you'll sell your property on the last day of a buyer's market. And you will buy your property in the first 2 months of a seller's market. I mean, the other way around. You'll sell in a seller's market. You'll buy in the first 2 months of a buyer's market.
Right.
But you know what? I have almost never been that lucky.
Yeah.
So we take what we can get. I call that the poison pill. You just have to be realistic.
Yeah. And yeah, especially knowing what you're looking for is such a big piece to investing in any asset class. I mean, especially within storage, as far as, you know, having that buy box or that range, or, you know, being able to spot those deals that will work with your business model, because there's so many different ways that people manage storage facilities. And so knowing what you're looking for, you know, prior to even being ready to buy it, and but then having that flexibility where you can move pretty quickly to be able to buy those assets when they come up is vital.
Absolutely.
So you did mention, you know, prior when we were talking a little bit about you kind of dabbled in storage a little bit, or you had a story about it. I'd love to hear the.
Yeah, you know, this was a bunch of years ago. It was right after the crash. And I was sitting there going, you know what? I do love self-storage. I think it's a good sector. It's definitely depressed along with everything else. And I was watching my mom, as she had gotten older. I was helping manage her finances, and I kept seeing all these bills for self-storage units. I go, Mom, what the world are you doing? So, but brilliant Dave, inside, I told you this was going to be a mistake, right? That I was going to invest to. Yeah. Instead of jumping in to self-storage, I bought my mom a 5,000 square foot house, thinking that she could get rid of all her self-storage facilities. She had 7 of them.
No way.
Not facilities, units.
Yeah.
And moved them all into a full basement that was totally empty of 2,500 square feet. I thought, this is how we win this game. When she passed away 6 years later, we had a 5,000 square foot house. Do you know how many storage units she had? 7. Mm-hmm. She didn't give up one of them.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I realized, man, I was betting against the house.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter how much room you have. That I think is a law of thermodynamics, that your junk will increase to the proportional amount of vacuum space you're able to rent at a self-storage. And you know, I once offered her $1,000 to get rid of a rack of clothes in one of her storage units. And she refused.
Yeah.
Dude, did that tell us everything we need to know about self-storage? It's bulletproof.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right too, as far as like people accumulating to whatever space they have. You know, they say like a python will adapt and they'll grow based on the space of living that they have. And I mean, people are very much the same way. I know me and my wife, we built a house recently. So we went from a home that was, you know, 1600 square feet to nearly 3000 square feet. And within a year it was like, oh wow, like we don't have a whole lot of space anymore. How did we move, you know? And so it's really funny how you just kind of accumulate things to fill the space that you're in, and then you need more.
It's ridiculous. And for everybody that's watched these reality shows, you know, Pond Wars and all that kind of stuff, or Storage Wars, that kind of stuff, you realize that the junk that's in those units, you're paying more in rental for 3 months than anything in that thing is worth.
Right.
But nobody cares. Dude, I'm telling you, I'm sold. I'm waiting for the next downturn and I'll be investing right beside you.
Awesome. Well, yeah. As far as, you know, somebody that's looking to sell a property, maybe just one final, just good piece of advice, maybe off of a topic that we already kind of talked about as an investor, what's something that you usually tell somebody that's maybe new to investments, as far as, you know, just a good piece of advice to get started?
There's two voices you need to listen to. There's the voice of the market. And you got to learn that if you want to be a real estate investor, because the market will tell you where to invest and what to invest in and how to invest. But you have to hear that. The 1031 exchange allows you to listen to the market and invest anywhere in the United States where you want to, where it tells you to, in any type of real estate that it's telling you, in any way, whether that's selling one property and buying several, or selling several properties to buy something bigger. Listen to the market. Secondly, listen to yourself. Where are you in your personal life cycle? The 1031 exchange can accommodate anything. Are you at the beginning of a journey where you've got lots of energy and very little money? Then sell that single family property and go buy two or three. Mm-hmm. Buy value adds. Fix them up because you like hammer and nails. Right. Are you at the stage where you have more money and less energy? Sell several properties. Start to put them into larger projects like multifamily or commercial. Are you at a point in your life where it's time to start enjoying some of the fruits of your labor and you want to figure out how to do that? Sell your whatever your investment properties are and go buy vacation rentals where you can use them a few weeks a year yourself mm-hmm. and get the enjoyment. Are you trying to retire? 1031 ahead of time into that area where you want to retire. And here's the greatest hack that I could give anybody. When you do that, so you sell all your properties in Cleveland to go retire in Sarasota, Florida. And now all your properties are in Sarasota waiting for you. When you sell your last home that you live in Cleveland, the first, if you're married, that $500,000 of profit is going to be tax-free. Don't buy another primary residence. Instead, convert one of your former investment properties into your next primary residence. Now, when you do that, the conversion doesn't create a taxable event. All that deferred tax stays deferred, stays okay. working to you. Plus all the tax-free money that you didn't have to use to buy a house. Right. And once you've lived in that long enough, you will start to eliminate the tax deferred part, and it will become slowly over time tax free.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I did not know that. So.
And then finally, when you die, I always leave this to last because it's not what we like to think about, but we're all heading there. When you die, all of that deferred tax in all of your properties for over all your time is eliminated. Your heirs inherit your real estate at what's called a step-up in basis. You don't pay the tax. Your estate doesn't pay the tax. They don't pay the tax. It's a tax-free legacy of wealth to your heirs. So that's a pretty handy tool.
Absolutely. And I think that's everybody's goal, is to get away from the tax a little bit, right? So that, especially if you don't want to pass that burden on, for sure, to your kids or wherever your estate would go. So awesome, Dave. Well, if anybody had any questions and they wanted to contact you directly, what's the best way to get in touch with you and your company?
Yeah, you'll probably put these in the show notes, but Amazon, you can pick the book up. Our website is intentionally designed to be educational. We have a 52 short, they're all short, promise, because I got ADD, YouTube channel, 52 videos there with all kinds of hacks, calculators you could play around with, articles we've written, access to talk to us directly at the1031investor.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'll make sure I put them in the notes and the blog and stuff when we put it out with the podcast. And thank you so much for your time and for your the knowledge that you shared with us today and kind of your experiences as well. So I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to be with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Self Storage Insight Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Just a quick reminder, this episode was brought to you by CC Storage. CC Storage is a no-cost property management software that allows you to pass the fees for credit card processing onto your tenants, freeing up some CapEx space for your business and helping you more efficiently run your storage facility. If you'd like to learn more about CC Storage, click the link in the description below, and we hope to see you again for our next episode.